It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What happened in Flint, Michigan, and also in Toledo, Ohio, are only two of several high-profile incidents of public health crises arising from drinking water contamination around the country in recent years. So this hour, we want to take a look at how drinking water supplies here in Iowa are susceptible to similar vulnerabilities. We'll be talking with participants of an upcoming symposium titled Iowa's Drinking Water. Could Flint happen here? It's happening tomorrow, that symposium, Friday, June 17th in Des Moines. This first half hour, we want to talk with one of the participants coming to that symposium. Peter Glick is president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute. That's a think tank with the goal of influencing efforts towards sustainable water policies. He's a leading scientist, an innovator, and communicator on global water and climate issues. In 2003, Glick received the prestigious MacArthur Genius Fellowship. He's been named a visionary on the environment by the BBC and is a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He's also the author and editor of many scientific papers and 10 books. Peter Glick, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You're starting us off this hour as we talk about drinking water quality. Outline what you see as the biggest challenges facing drinking water quality in the U.S.
Sure. So in the U.S., we have a pretty remarkable drinking water system that we've developed over the last century and a half. Our urban water systems are delivering high-quality, low-cost, reliable water to us 24 hours a day. It's really sort of a remarkable system that we've long taken for granted. But it does face challenges. It's not as good as it could be. We're underinvesting. We're not spending the money that we ought to be spending to get rid of the old equipment and the old pipes and put in the new systems. We're not monitoring our water as well as we ought to. And there's some new threats. You know, the climate's changing, temperatures are going up. That affects our water resources around the country. So we have a good water system, but I think it, A, could be better, and B, I think we're not really preparing for the kinds of changes that are coming.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about the underinvesting in our infrastructure. What do we need to update, and what are the consequences we're experiencing of not updating?
Yeah, so of course, a lot of the infrastructure in our cities was built a long time ago, 100 years ago in some of our cities, especially on the east coast of the United States. And that infrastructure, like any infrastructure, needs to be maintained. It needs to be upgraded when things wear out. And what I'm really talking about is the pipes in our streets, the pipes in our homes, the wastewater treatment plants that collect our wastewater and treat it and then throw it back into the rivers or back into the ocean, our water treatment systems in the beginning that deliver the water in our pipes. All of that stuff has to be maintained. It has to be operated and upgraded. And we're not doing that enough. We're not spending enough money, literally, to take care of that stuff. And what we saw in Flint was partly a combination of underinvestment. You know, they haven't gotten rid of the old lead pipes that we built years ago, and we didn't understand for a while that lead was a problem, but now we do, but we haven't gotten rid of the old lead pipes, mm-hmm. or the pipes that break in our streets. So partly that was an infrastructure problem and an underinvestment problem. Now, of course, partly Flint was a management problem, too, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit later, but we're not spending enough money.
Okay,
that
so
it's a big part of the challenge.
Just to make sure that we all know, we heard the news reports, of course, what happened in Flint. Remind us what happened in Flint to their water supply.
So it was a complicated series of events, but very simply, what happened was they changed the source of the water they were taking. They moved from Detroit's water system that they were part of to a different source for water. And every water is a little bit different. And when you change the source of the water, you have to pay attention to the chemical composition. You have to pay attention to what that water is doing to the pipes that exist. And they didn't pay enough attention to it. And the new source had a little bit different chemical composition, but it led to a change in the way it interacted with the pipes. And it led to more leaching of some bad things that are in the pipes but weren't previously being leached out, and in particular lead. There was more corrosion, more lead got into the water. It wasn't as though they were putting lead in the water. It was that came from the old pipes that we failed to remove. And they weren't monitoring carefully enough. They didn't pay enough attention. And so there was some indication that the water quality was worsening, but this was part of the management failure. They didn't monitor it carefully enough, and when they did monitor it, they sort of ignored the information they were getting, and that led to people drinking water that was not of the quality that they ought to be drinking. It led to health problems, it led to contamination, and it led to what was the crisis, really, in Flint.
Mm-hmm. And the crisis in Toledo, Ohio, was completely different. This involved blue-green algae and toxins produced by the algae. Am I correct?
Yes, that's right. So the problem in Toledo was, that's exactly right, it was a little bit of a different problem. In that case, the source of the water was Lake Erie. And, of course, any water agency takes water from a source and they treat it to a very high standard and then they put it in the pipes. In this case, the source water became contaminated with algae. The temperatures in Lake Erie had gone up. The nutrients levels in Lake Erie were such that algae were encouraged to grow. This is, of course, a problem in Iowa as well during the hot weather.
Oh, it sure is.
And so all of a sudden, they were just faced with a lot of algae that the water system was not really designed to take out. And they had to shut down Toledo's water system for a little bit of time while they figured out a way to get rid of that algae. And, you know, they were able to deal with it over time, but it was a challenge that they were not really prepared to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a third example is, you know, I don't know if your listeners remember, but around the same time, there was a big chemical spill in a river in West Virginia, and the city of Charleston, West Virginia, had to shut down its water system, not because of natural algae or not because of lead like in Flint, but because of a chemical that an industry accidentally spilled. So we sort of have to pay a lot of attention to our drinking water to make sure that we're protecting against all of these kinds of threats.
Mm-hmm. So you're coming to Iowa to speak. Tell us, when you look at these crises and others that are, I'm sure you've studied, what can they specifically teach us here in Iowa? What are our drinking water vulnerabilities?
Well, I think the lesson is probably the same for every water district everywhere. And frankly, this is true globally as well. The first thing we have to do is to protect the quality of our source water, protect the quality of the water that we're tapping into. Now, New York City's water comes from upstate New York, and they've protected a lot of land area from certain kinds of development to make sure that the water itself doesn't get contaminated in the first place, like Toledo, Ohio. If Lake Erie is clean, the job of the water district in Toledo, Ohio, sure is a lot easier than if the source water is contaminated. So that's the first step. The second step is treat the water that you get to the highest standard for drinking. And we have laws at the federal level for water quality that we're allowed to consume for drinking. And our water treatment systems are designed to produce that quality of water. But our water systems are old, and there's new technology out there that can do a much better job of water treatment, and we need to invest in those more modern filtration systems and membrane systems and ozone. I mean, there are lots of different technologies to make sure that whatever the source of the water is, we treat it to a standard so that what we put in the pipes is the best quality we can get.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is the distribution system. You can put in great water in the distribution system, but if the distribution system is bad, like in Flint, Michigan, where they had lead, then the risk is what comes out of the pipes isn't as good as it ought to be. And so we need to upgrade our distribution systems, get rid of all those old lead pipes, make sure that the water that comes out at the end is as good as required by federal law.
If you've just joined us, Peter Glick is my guest this half hour. He's coming to participate in a symposium to be held tomorrow in Des Moines titled Iowa's Drinking Water, Could Flint Happen Here? Peter Glick is president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute. You've talked about underinvestment as a problem, monitoring as a problem or a challenge. Talk about the third that you named, the new threats such as climate change. What can you tell us about the impact of climate change on our drinking water supply?
There are a number of new threats out there. So set aside climate change for a second. There are some new contaminants out there that are not regulated by our drinking water standards. You know, we have two primary federal laws that protect water. The Clean Water Act that protects sort of the source water and says you can't dump industrial wastes into our water systems. And the Safe Drinking Water Act, which basically determines the quality of our tap water. And it sets standards, and the federal government sets them, and the water agencies locally have to manage and meet those standards. Both of those laws need to be upgraded. They were done 30, 40 years ago, and there are new contaminants out there that are not regulated that we need to regulate. But the federal government has not been very good about, you know, there's sort of an anti-regulation mentality now, but the truth is there are certain regulations that are pretty important, and safe drinking water, I would argue, is one of them. And Congress ought to get off the dime, and they ought to revisit the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act and strengthen them for some of the things that we were not paying attention to or that we didn't know 30 or 40 years ago we ought to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
On the issue of climate change, this is really a new challenge. All of our systems, the distribution systems, the collection systems, the treatment systems, they were designed on the assumption that the climate wasn't changing, that tomorrow's climate would be the same as yesterday's climate. And that's no longer true. We now know that we're changing, we humans are changing the climate. And we also know that some of the biggest impacts of climate change are going to be on water resources. Higher temperatures, more demand for water, more outbreaks of algae that we're seeing because of higher temperatures, changes in rainfall patterns and melting snow in the mountains much faster, a whole series of things that will affect our and are affecting our water systems. And water managers aren't dealing with that. They're not prepared to deal with that. So there needs to be a deeper conversation about what do we know about climate change? How is it going to affect our water systems? And then how can we better manage the systems to deal with these changing conditions?
Peter Glick, you're based in California. You concern yourself with sustainable water policies. I wonder if a lawsuit here in Iowa is on your radar, the Des Moines Water Works lawsuit. It's against three northwest Iowa counties, Buena Vista, Calhoun, and Sac counties, claiming that their drainage districts there act as conduits for nitrates to move from farm fields into the Raccoon River. And these are sources of drinking water for about 500,000 residents in the Des Moines area. Is that on your radar?
So the issue is on my radar. The specific lawsuit I'm not that familiar with, and it would probably be inappropriate for me to comment on. But this is exactly the point about protecting source water. It's one thing for a water district to get contaminated water and then to figure out how to clean it up. But the smartest thing to do is not to contaminate our source water in the first place. And this is another good example where we've done a pretty good job with the Clean Water Act, the federal law that protects water, for industrial pollutants. You know, we don't let our steel industries or our auto industry or our chemical refining industry dump untreated waste into our streams anymore. We used to do that, but that's what the Clean Water Act in the 1970s was designed to stop. And mostly, we've done a good job of that. We have not done a good job of what we call non-point source pollution, which is exactly what you're talking about here, runoff from ag land of nitrates or fertilizers of different kinds or chemical pesticides and herbicides. We're not very good at controlling these more diffuse source of pollutants, which are now the primary source of pollutants for the Great Lakes or for our rivers in Iowa. And that adds burden to the job of water districts that have to feed water to a million people.
Mm-hmm.
They're now faced with, look, what's going on upstream? How do I get the people upstream to do a better job of preventing pollution that will make my job as a water district to serve a million people easier?
Is there that's still unresolved. Yeah. Is there a solution or a direction you can point to that satisfies both the agricultural industry? Of course, they don't want to pay for this. The Waterworks wants to put the bill, give them the bill for the extra equipment, facilities it takes to clean up the water.
Well, the solution is to figure out a way to do the things we want. That is, have a healthy agricultural community, have a strong farming economy that has less unanticipated or undesired impact on the environment. You know, we want to grow food, but we don't want to contaminate our waterways. It's not in a farmer's interest to spend more money on fertilizers or pesticides than they need to, only to have that excess chemical stuff run off into our waterways. The question is, how do we best do that? What are there incentives to help farmers do a better job with chemical management? Are there incentives that let an urban agency perhaps provide some of the funding to improve water quality upstream, because they can spend less money downstream in ultimate treatment? I think there are tools that we can use to serve both purposes, but at the moment there's no real requirement that we do that.
Peter Glick is my guest, president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute, coming to Iowa to speak on Friday at a symposium titled Iowa's Drinking Water, Could Flint Happen Here? Peter, I wonder, I haven't heard much talk from candidates in this election year about water quality. Have you?
No, of course. I mean, water is my thing. I wish political candidates at every level, from the local level to the federal level, paid more attention to water. I do think we did see a little bit of discussion during the primaries on the Democratic and the Republican side around Flint, Michigan, because Flint was such a big issue. There are things the federal government needs to do around water. Water is often a very local issue. Often we just need to deal with our local water districts. It ought to be a local election issue. But there are things the federal government ought to be doing in terms of streamlining regulation, of upgrading regulation, of providing money for investment in some of these infrastructure improvements we're talking about, helping farmers become more efficient in terms of their water use or chemical use through things in the farm bill. We have seen bits and pieces of that. But I would love to see a debate about the sciences of climate change and about water resources and about energy at the federal level, because those are issues that affect every one of us.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell if you had such a debate between a Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump? What you would expect based on what they've said so far?
Well, I'm a scientist, and so it's always a little hard to weigh in. I mean, I have personal political opinions and preferences. I don't think there's a whole lot of evidence of where they would stand. Donald Trump was out here and made some comments about the drought in California that I thought were a little insensitive to the science. I think he's probably educatable. I think they're all educatable, one would hope. Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, made some speeches about global water issues that suggested some interest and knowledge about some of the challenges that at the international level the U.S. could contribute to in terms of diplomacy around conflicts over water, about the need to provide safe water for many of the people overseas who don't have it, and the role of the State Department and the U.S. aid agencies. That was her responsibility at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to have a debate about really what should the U.S. be doing? What's the appropriate role for federal agencies versus state governments versus local agencies versus individuals? You know, there are things we need to be doing at the individual level. And I'll cross my fingers that we have that debate.
Mm-hmm. Take us outside the U.S. briefly. We only have 3 or 4 minutes left, but you mentioned international issues. Tell us about a place in the world where quality drinking water is a dire problem.
Oh, so as bad as we see a problem like Flint or Toledo or Charleston, West Virginia, much of the rest of the world, the developing world in particular, would love to have a water quality system as good as the United States. They'd love to have tap water as high quality and reliable and cheap as we have here. There's 700 million people worldwide that don't have access to safe drinking water, something most of us take completely for granted. So a lot of work needs to be done at the international level to provide basic water services for much of the world's poor. And you know, the world's working on that. The UN's working on that. The U.S. aid is working on that. So that's a big issue. There are lots of contamination problems that we've dealt with in the U.S. in terms of industrial wastes that they need to deal with. China is a nightmare in terms of development. They've grown enormously, their economy has expanded enormously, but their water quality is a nightmare compared to ours, and they need to do a much better job investing and protecting water quality. There are political conflicts over water. A lot of water is shared between two countries, and we don't think about that much in the United States, although sometimes state A versus state B fight over a river that crosses a state border. But, you know, you see the Tigris and the Euphrates, which are shared by Turkey and Syria and Iraq, and there are political conflicts there that are not adequately being addressed. So we worry about our water here, but there are much bigger problems in many other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Peter Glick, perhaps you can leave us with some concrete ways that you would say we need to change, we Iowans or Californians or whoever, the change we need to make in looking at water and using water. You mention in your writing that this is the third age of water. Perhaps you can tell us what that will be.
So here's the good news. The good news is I do think, despite these challenges we face, despite the bad news we hear every day, that there are opportunities to do things much more effectively and carefully and efficiently and successfully than we've been doing. We see great improvements in water use efficiency. Basically, we see people doing a lot more with less water. We're washing our clothes and flushing our toilets with less water. We're growing more food with less water. That's water efficiency improvements, and I see examples of that around the country every day. There are new technologies to treat water to any standard we want, and we just need to invest more in them. There's a new awareness that climate change is a real problem, and that we have to integrate it into our thinking around a whole bunch of things. And I think we're seeing a growing realization that, A, that's a problem, and, B, that there are solutions, there are things that we can be doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think our institutions need to be a little better. We have to educate people a little differently about water. There's a lot that individuals can do in terms of what kind of appliances they buy, what kind of landscape they have in their backyards, what kind of diets they choose that will ultimately have big impacts on the quantity of water we have and the quality of the water we produce. And I think the more conversations we have about that, the better.
Okay, thank you very much. Peter Glick is president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute, a think tank in California, with the goal of influencing efforts towards sustainable water policies. He'll be speaking Friday in Des Moines at a symposium titled Iowa's Drinking Water, Could Flint Happen Here? Thank you very much, Peter Glick.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, I'll talk with one of the initial investigators in Flint during that water crisis, and also we'll discuss how much we know about what's in your tap water. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back in just a minute. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, indeed talking about water this hour on River to River, drinking water quality more specifically. We've had a number of high-profile drinking water crises recently in our news, most notably, I'm sure you remember, Flint, Michigan, also Toledo, Ohio. That was with the toxins from the blue-green algae that contaminated their system. So this hour, we're talking with a number of people connected to the topic of drinking water quality, most of them taking part in a symposium to be held in Des Moines tomorrow, titled Iowa's Drinking Water, Could Flint Happen Here? If you have questions this half hour about tap water, drinking water, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or find us on Facebook. Well, do you remember that news from 2014 from Flint? Flint switched its water source to the Flint River from Detroit's municipal system. That was to save money, and this exposed residents of Flint to dangerous levels of lead. That's because the river water was more corrosive than that of the Detroit system and caused more lead to leach from the aging pipes there. Lead, of course, very dangerous, especially for children. Pregnant women are especially vulnerable. It was a city of 100,000 residents had to switch its water source back to the Detroit's municipal system. That happened in October of last year. Let's talk for a few minutes with an initial investigator during that Flint water crisis, Siddhartha Roy is with us. He goes by Sid, a doctoral student and graduate researcher in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Virginia Tech, a student leader in the Flint Water Study. Hello, Sid.
Hi, Ben. Good to be here.
Good to have you with us. This firsthand experience, you were a member of a 25-member team that looked into it. Tell us how you got involved and briefly tell us what was found.
Well, it began with Flint mother, Leanne Walters, who got concerned about developmental issues in one of her twins and the fact that the water in her tap had been coming out brown for many months. And so looking for answers, she figured out, A, that her kid had lead poisoning, and B, the city was not practicing federally mandated corrosion control law, which is required in case a city has lead pipes and lead plumbing. So Leanne, really concerned, she got in touch with an EPA scientist, Miguel Del Toro, and we sampled with him in Leanne's house back in April of 2015, and we literally found hazardous levels of lead coming out of her tap. So Miguel wrote a memo using all this data in June of last year, and this memo went to EPA and the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, and the hope was with all this data from Leanne's house and the fact that the city was not practicing federal law, action would be taken. But instead, this brilliant scientist was silenced, and Flint residents were told nothing would happen. So Leanne called us and said, we have to do something. And that's how the Flint Water Study research team began investigating back in August of 2015.
It led to a public health emergency being declared by President Obama, hundreds of millions of dollars of relief for the Flint residents. And it sparked a safe water debate here in the United States. So also why we're talking about it here in Iowa, Sid. They found other things you found in the water besides lead, but incredible amounts of lead. This is, I'm looking at it, more than 100 times more lead in the water than the maximum amount allowed.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's important to remember that there is no safe level of lead to begin with. But the EPA has a 15 parts per billion action level. So the law says action should be taken if more than 10% of homes have that. Leanne's house had 13,000 parts per billion of lead. Remember, zero is safe. 13,000 was what was coming out of her tap. So, and we saw this problem across the city when we sampled with residents. So it is incredible that the numbers literally, even to this day, astound me. And this is not unique to Flint, because the entire country has millions of lead pipes. Virtually every U.S. city, you look at D.C., you look at Denver, you look at Detroit, New Orleans. So, having said that, I don't want to alarm people into thinking this is epidemic, but as long as you have lead in your system, there is always a potential for contamination and exposure.
Okay, so right now, all of our lead pipes, and we have plenty of them in Iowa, are simply not being corroded because of the type of water going through them. Is that right? So that lead is staying put in the pipe and not dissolving, so to speak, in the water? Is that a correct understanding of it?
So it's both. It's the type of water, and it's also corrosion control treatment. So, for example, Des Moines Water Works, they actually practice corrosion control, which ensures that a protective coating forms between the pipe and the water, and the lead stays on the pipe and out of the water. So that's, required. So that's a good thing. That's why lead levels are low in many, in homes with lead pipe. But remember, it's not perfect. I mean, the fact is, at the end of the day, you have a lead pipe. So if a piece just falls off and it ends up in your drinking water glass, there you go. So it's very good, but it's not 100% effective.
What's Flint like today? I understand that the drinking water's still not suitable for consumption.
Right. So, Flint has an aging infrastructure like many old U.S. cities. I mean, it's ending its life. The 18 months of damage that occurred with this corrosive water literally ate through pipes. So now that Flint is back on Detroit, we are practicing corrosion control. Everything is fine. So the lead levels are dropping. But again, the pipes have been damaged so severely, the lead is still coming out, but it's improving, But it's not perfect.
Okay. Well, what are the lessons from Flint for Iowa here? You sort of touched on them, but tell us specifically, what do you think needs to be done in Iowa that we may avoid the catastrophe that Flint experienced?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, first off, realizing that our water infrastructure is critical, and Iowa definitely, like all other states, needs to look at its infrastructure and see how they could better, you know, look at their assets and what pipes need replacement, because pipes are under the ground and people usually forget them because you can't see it, but they are nearing their life. I mean, investing our water infrastructure is critical. So that's number one. Number two, I think, is looking at federal laws. So just for example, in terms of lead, we have the lead and copper rule, which came out in 1991, and it has not been updated, you know, since. So 10% of homes, according to the law, can have any amount of lead coming out of their taps, and the city would be in compliance. So think of this for a second. Flint is in the midst of an emergency, and you have National Guard walking the streets, and Flint still is in compliance of the law because they cheated. So looking at the laws and how you sample water for homes, so Iowa definitely leads, like the country, to look at the EPA's law and ensure that they're actually meeting it and surpassing it and continuously monitoring their water system. That is critical. And one final thing, I think every homeowner, I mean, we think about these things as a big issue, as a citywide issue, as a nationwide issue. But for me, if I'm a homeowner, I would, you know, first of all, find out that if I have an old home, I'll go in my, you know, find out if I have a lead pipe, for example, or ask my water utility for answers and for testing. We all need to be vigilant about this issue.
And quickly, if your house is older than what year should you worry about lead pipes? When did they stop using lead pipes?
Right. So it's amazing. I mean, until 1986, it was perfectly legal for the country to have lead pipes installed and lead solder installed inside home plumbing. So if your home is older than 1980 and it has not been remodeled, I'd recommend at least figuring out if you do have a lead pipe or not.
Okay, thank you very much. Siddhartha Roy is a doctoral student, graduate researcher in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Virginia Tech, student leader in the Flint Water Study. Thank you for sharing your insights with us and your experiences, Sid.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, finishing up our hour talking about drinking water quality. There's a symposium tomorrow titled Iowa's Drinking Water, Could Flint Happen Here? Happening in Des Moines. Joining me now, two participants in that symposium. Dana Colpin is with us. He's a research hydrologist for the U.S. Geological Survey in Iowa City and project chief for the USGS Toxic Programs Emerging Contaminants Project. Dana Colpin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us, Pete Wire, interim director of the Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination at the University of Iowa. Pete, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben.
We want to briefly, in the time that we have left, the 10 or so minutes we have, to ask Dana what's in our water. What do we know about what's in our water based on the research you've done? And Pete, more to look at what are the health impacts. So, Dana, let's have you go first. Tell us about the work that you're doing and what it says about the contaminants in our water here in Iowa.
Yeah, at the USGS, as the nation's science organization, really don't get into policy or regulation aspects. We're really trying to understand what's going on with our water resources. So the project that I deal with is a national scale project. It's multidisciplinary in terms of, you know, chemists, microbiologists, biologists, all are coming together to really understand, in our case, looking at under-investigated compounds, whether it's pharmaceuticals, hormones, that's kind of got the most attention. But really, beyond kind of the traditional contaminants that such as nitrate that people have looked at. So what we do is conduct what I call sourced receptor type of research. We want to understand what are the sources of these contaminants. When they get into the environment, how are they moving through the system, both in streams and underground into groundwater? Are they rapidly degrading, absorbing? And ultimately now the big question is, what does that mean to both the ecosystem and in the longer term, what does that mean to human health? So it's really looking at a whole range of things. And what I'll be talking about on tomorrow's symposium is just kind of highlight the point that what is really out there is not just a single contaminant or two. It's actually a complex mixture of a soup of organic contaminants that really don't know at this point what does all that mean.
Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at our streams and it appears clear and so forth, and you're studying a couple of streams here in Iowa very closely, what are you finding?
Yeah, exactly. So we're looking at a stream in north central Iowa, a very rural stream. So, very few people out there, but it's mainly corn and soybeans, just like a typical across Iowa, but there's boatloads of hogs. So that's kind of a nice representation of a rural stream, which you have minimal direct human impact in terms of waste or treatment plants, for example. And then we're corresponding that with a small stream near Ankeny, where it's still row crops in the upper end, but then it rapidly evolves into a waste or treatment plant. So we've seen in the rural setting, we found as many as 75 contaminants that were present, a broad mixture of pesticides and other things. And on the urban side, we found up to 50 pharmaceuticals in that single water sample. So looking at it, it's a nice, you see lots of trees and the setting looks good, but yes, there's lots of organics there. And just need to understand what that means.
And these water sources, these streams feed into water supplies for towns and cities?
Exactly. The one in central Iowa is a small stream that then feeds into Des Moines River, which is actually a source of drinking water, exactly.
Can you talk briefly, before we talk about the health impacts here with Pete a little bit, about groundwater? A lot of our drinking water comes from sources below the surface.
Exactly. And as a whole, I would say groundwater, just by its definition, is generally has fewer contaminants, lower concentrations, because it has that buffering of impact where water flows through and it has more time for processes such as degradation, absorption to take place. But these compounds, many of these compounds are mobile and persistent enough, so just because you're pulling from a groundwater source, you may be in slightly better shape, but there's no guarantee that there's still not a complex set of compounds that are present even in our groundwater.
Let's turn to you, Pete Weyer. Of the Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination at the University of Iowa. So put this in a public policy, a public health perspective. How do you begin to look at this when Dana is saying here we're discovering a whole soup of things we didn't even know about?
Well, one of the things you have to keep in mind when you're looking at health impacts from drinking water contaminants is that health effects, risk factors for health effects are things like lifestyle, genetics, diet. The environment plays a role. But you have to take all those into account when you're looking at risk for certain health outcomes. For example, things like cancer or birth defects. Tomorrow at the symposium in Des Moines, we're going to have a session looking at the Flint lead contamination. That's more of an acute exposure. And so there's a recognizable and identifiable outcome that you can find fairly quickly with that. Dana mentioned mixtures. Mixtures are very important. So that's one of the things that comes into play when you're trying to figure out what exactly is contaminant A doing in terms of health.
Mm-hmm. So when you hear about what we know about what's in our water, and it seems to be, if I'm reading this right, a lot we don't know about what's in our water, and it certainly depends on what town or city you're in and the water source your municipality is drawing on. What are your biggest concerns identified as the health concerns for all of us here in Iowa consuming the water?
Well, being that we're a huge agricultural area, we are looking mainly at agricultural contaminants, things like nitrates, some herbicides, that type of stuff that we're investigating. Also, because our water quality, especially from surface water sources, is fairly needs a lot of treatment to get it to the point where Peter Glick was talking about safe drinking water. So there's a lot of disinfection of that water to make sure that there are no microbial contaminants in there. And when you do that, compounds can be developed or made that are called disinfection byproducts that can also be a problem with health. So we're also investigating what happens when you treat the water in the finished water. What's in the finished water that might be a problem?
Mm-hmm. And so investigating, any results of the investigation so far?
Well, we've been looking a lot at things like in terms of mixtures. We're looking at disinfection byproducts with nitrate, disinfection byproducts with atrazine, some of those compounds. And there have been some published studies on cancer effects and some birth defects as well.
Mm-hmm. So what do we know? Go into that because we are and will be for the foreseeable future an agricultural state. What do we know about the health impact of nitrates, herbicides, the other things that don't necessarily stay in the fields that run into our water supply?
Well, it's interesting because the drinking water standard for nitrate is 10 parts per million as nitrogen. And so we're looking at long-term low-dose exposures in Iowa populations for nitrate in combination with disinfection byproducts and other things. And we're finding that there are increased risks for things like bladder cancer, thyroid cancer, some other cancers at less than the drinking water standard. And this is in populations that have been drinking this water for a long, long time, mm-hmm. let's say in excess of 20 years. Maybe 5 to 10 parts per million nitrate is a problem. Mm-hmm. Disinfection byproducts have long been known to be risk factors for cancer.
Is there a potential ticking bomb? Perhaps that's not the right parallel there, but I'm just thinking in 10 or 20 years, are we going to be looking back at and perhaps listening back to a conversation like this and saying, I wish we had known about this because we're all consuming this water and look what health effects it had.
You know, I think I'll jump in here. I think that we're talking mixtures, and because nitrate is so pervasive, you know, it's in the diet, it's in the water, it's, you know, in the soil, it's everywhere, that maybe nitrate is really not, maybe not really what's important, might be a surrogate for something else. It's so hard to figure out what are in those mixtures that we may be on the track for something, but is it really nitrate or what is it? That's something we need to look at.
Pete Weyer, in your position, imagine you keep an eye on what's been happening in at our legislature. Has anything been happening in these regards to look at our water infrastructure and to find out if there are contaminants there that are going to impact our health?
You know, from the 30,000-foot view, it's encouraging that the legislature has moved to the point where they are discussing different ideas. This past session, nothing got passed, but there was some good discussion. And so I think it looks good for the future, hopefully next session, that some things will be done to move that process forward.
Mm-hmm. Dana Copeland, let me ask you about the pharmaceuticals getting into the drinking water. Many of us don't think about that. Many of us consume all kinds of pharmaceuticals that finds its way to the drinking water. How?
Well, it's a combination. It's normal use. We take our medications. It does its intended feature, and then we excrete it and we flush it down the toilet. So that's probably the primary use. But then there's the unused and expired medications that people just, without thinking about it, will flush it down the toilet.
Do not do that. That is the worst thing
you can do. It goes right through the wastewater treatment plant. They were not intended to remove these compounds, and they can blast right into the environment. So I think, you know, just normal use, it certainly has a lot of beneficial aspects, but we're now finding that growing evidence that at least some of these compounds can have environmental effects, like exposure of antidepressants to fatted minnows makes them slower to react to predators. And when you're in the food chain, you don't want to be slower to react to predators. So these kind of...
So these pharmaceuticals that we've consumed are actually affecting our wildlife.
Yeah. I mean, not necessarily every single one of them, but there's growing cases that is happening. So that's something we need to be cognizant of. Obviously, there's benefits from using pharmaceuticals, but maybe we need to think about greener pharmaceuticals that break down quicker, still have the attendant actions, but now can be have less environmental consequences from them getting to the environment.
We have about a minute left. Can I give the final word to you, Pete Weyer, about that, pharmaceuticals or something else you didn't mention? There's so much to talk about in this field.
You know, I think just again getting back to what Peter Glick was saying earlier, that the main point here is source water protection. We need to make sure that we do a better job of keeping our rivers and streams and groundwater as clean as we can, because it's easier to treat that way. It's less expensive. It's better for the public health. And so that is something that is extremely important, and also infrastructure investment, as they were saying. So.
And, of course, if you keep the source water relatively clean, you're also doing a favor for the wildlife and the plant growth and all of that in our state, not to mention the fact that it takes a lot of money to clean up water that's contaminated, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking about us drinking water quality with us, ending this hour, as we've talked about in an upcoming symposium. Dana Colpin and Pete Weyer are participants in that symposium tomorrow in Des Moines. Iowa's Drinking Water, Could Flint Happen Here? That's the title of the symposium. Dana Colpin, research hydrologist for the U.S. Geological Survey in Iowa City, and Pete Wire, interim director of the Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination at the University of Iowa. Thank you both for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Lauren Knutson. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about the impacts of the Orlando shooting here in Iowa. We'll talk with three people concerned with that. That's when we continue tomorrow on this program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.